I've heard it said that we in the Uniting Church don't read the epistles very much. And by contrast with some of the more evangelical Christian traditions, I guess that's probably true. We have a bit of a tendency in the Uniting Church, I think, to focus a lot of our reading on the gospel passages from the lectionaries. And I'm not suggesting that that's a bad thing. I mean, reading the Gospels, reading the accounts of the life and the teaching of Jesus, that seems pretty core business for those who would be Jesus' followers. But I was reflecting on this as we looked at the reading today from Colossians. And I think that some of the difference, some of the reason, comes down to a perception of how the epistles and the gospels approach truth. So in the early days of my Christian life, in my teenage years, long ago now, I read the epistles avidly, seeking in them a sort of understanding, an explanation, an intellectually coherent laying out of the Christian faith. And the epistles seem to offer the promise of making sense. I didn't read the Gospels for those things. The Gospels were inspirational reading. Parables which hinted and teased at possibilities but stopped short of anything definitive. And then Jesus always answering a question with another question. And if there's one thing that's changed more than anything else in the way that I approach my understanding of the world and of the faith since then, it's this. I think I've come to distrust nuggets of isolated truth and to believe a lot more in stories. I can't remember who first said it to me, but I do remember the saying that if you want to understand humans and human interactions and society, the best place to start is with a good novel. That you'll understand more if you read Jane Austen than a psychology textbook. And it's not that I don't believe in absolutes and universal truth. I mean, I still am at heart a hardcore scientist. I don't believe that everyone's truth is good enough for them. I am not that sort of relativist. It's more that outside of those realms of hard science, truth isn't something that you can just take apart and look at in its isolated pieces as a set of facts. Not if you want to make sense of what it actually means. So over the years, I came to read the Gospels more and the Epistles less. Because what I'd learned to look for in the epistles were the bits which read like simple propositional statements, bite-sized declarations of truth that I could take and use and build with, the sort of thing I trusted less. As is often the case, that's quite a long introduction to explain that I made at least three fundamental errors in my approach to the epistles. The first is failing to recognize that the epistles are actually part of a story. That they actually weren't written as scientific treatises or even as statements of theology. That each of these letters is written in a context. It's written to real people in a particular place at a particular time, having particular issues. We don't know all the other bits of the story which were going on when they were written, but we do know that they played into a story. So mining them for nuggets of pure, clean truth was never the right way to understand them. The second mistake I made was creating a false dichotomy. Yes, I would say that the best place to start to understand humanity is with a novel, but there's also a lot to be learned in the texts of psychology or sociology or even economics or the rest. Our grasp of complex truth arises best from an interplay between the story and the interpretation of it, not from focusing on one alone. But the third mistake I made, and the one which is actually relevant for today, is I missed just how much of the epistles don't read like statements of fact. And in fact, just how much of the epistles are dedicated to the subject of prayer. Talking about prayer, exhorting believers to prayer, and over and again, as today, actually praying. And I wonder if there's actually anything which runs more counter to the idea of lumps of pure truth and is at the same time more congruent with the story of a personal God than prayer. Prayer doesn't fit in a world where everything can be broken down and analysed in small pieces. It doesn't fit in an overly rationalistic Enlightenment worldview. Prayer is irreducibly personal and interpersonal, unpredictable and uncontrollable. Prayer acknowledges that there are rules and yet expects them to be broken. Prayer makes sense in a story much more than in a textbook. And in this part of the story, in this letter written probably by Paul to the church at Colossae, the author certainly seems to think that prayer matters. And in our story, being followers of Jesus, it's probably worth knowing that Paul, who was so dedicated to drawing people into following Jesus and so committed to helping them in their ongoing following, that he put such an emphasis on praying for them. Since the day we heard of your faith, we have not ceased praying for you. Paul was writing to a group of Christians that he had had a hand, but probably an indirect hand, in leading. He may well never have met most of them. Now, I wonder how many ministers for that matter, could say the same thing of their prayers. We have not ceased praying for you. That commitment. Paul wants these people that he's heard of to continue in their walk as followers of Jesus. He has heard of their faith and he wants them to continue. And in this letter, he will give them lots of advice and warnings and encouragement, but he also never stops praying for them. And his prayers, we read, are characterized by thanks. In our prayers for you, we always thank God. Now, this isn't thanking God because these readers have been helpful to Paul. They aren't providing for his needs. They aren't giving him anything. As I say, he's never even met most of them. This isn't thanks for something he has received, and yet he begins his prayer with thanksgiving. It's not the thanks of simple gratitude. It's more the overflowing joy of people he has heard about and even without meeting, still cares about. When he hears about them and when he thinks about them and their faith, you get the sense it brings a smile to his face. They can't help but thank God for the news he has heard of them and of their walk as followers of Jesus. It feels to me a little bit like the thanksgiving of a parent looking at their child. Not thanks for what has been done for them, but simply thanks that they are. So Paul's prayer for others who are following Jesus starts in thanks, but it doesn't end there. He prays for them as people who are followers of Jesus, the theme of this series. And he prays for them to move on in that journey. He prays that they will grow and learn, praying for you, asking you may be filled with the knowledge of God's will. Paul's prayer reflects his priorities. He prays that those who he has heard of and cares for will know God's will. And not just know it, will be filled with the knowledge of God's will. That God's will won't just be a factor, won't just be an intellectual assent, won't just be something to be taken into consideration, but will be their animating principle. Because then their lives will reflect the one that they follow. Then their lives will reflect who they are and whose they are. I can't put it better than to read those words again. Asking you may be filled with the knowledge of God's will in all spiritual wisdom and understanding, so that you will lead lives worthy of the Lord, fully pleasing to him, as you bear fruit in every good work and as you grow in the knowledge of God. He prays with thanksgiving for these followers of Jesus that he loves, and he prays that they will be filled to overflowing with spiritual wisdom and understanding, with a deep knowledge of God's will, so that their lives will bear fruits, good fruits, in good works. And he prays one more thing for them. May you be made strong with all the strength that comes from his glorious power, and may you be prepared to endure everything with patience while joyfully giving thanks to the Father. He prays that they may be made strong, that they may be prepared and able to endure. Because he knows all too well that knowing and doing God's will is not going to be a walk in the park. It's not going to be easy. If it was easy, as they say, everyone would be doing it. Being filled with the knowledge of God's will and being animated by the things of God is not going to be easy or straightforward. Sometimes it may mean taking a stand which puts you outside of the comfortable views of your peers, of your culture. It may mean that there are things that you simply cannot go along with, things you cannot walk past and accept. Cries for justice might lead you into protest, into resistance, might lead you even into a struggle with those who hold power in our world. Standing with God for the marginalized might mean ridicule or opposition or contempt. And seeking the reign and the realm of God, God's will to be done on earth as in heaven, will surely mean facing failure, setbacks, disappointments. The only way to avoid failure is to set the bar way too low. And so Paul prays for these followers of Jesus that they will have strength, Strength, that is the strength of God's power. Strong enough to endure with patience. Strong enough not just to endure, but even in times of endurance, to give thanks to God. We began this series 4 weeks ago, followers of Jesus, reflecting on Pentecost, on the way that we are empowered to follow by the gift and the grace of God, by the indwelling of the Spirit sent at Pentecost. We end pretty much in the same place with these words from Paul's prayer. May you be made strong with all of the strength that comes from God's glorious power. Amen.